Well, can I start by saying welcome to this evening's discussion, which falls under the aegis of the European Institute. Could somebody put that right? Columbia University and the Department of International... International Relations at the London School of Economics. I suppose that it seems unfortunately rather appropriate that at a time of international tension and rapid change that we should wish to discuss from interregnum to general crisis, trends in international politics now. But at the same time, alongside that, there is our old friend globalization, about which we have heard a great deal at this London School of Economics. And one particular aspect of that, I think, is the way in which universities, including the London School of Economics, are forming links with universities in other parts of the world. And this discussion is in part also to celebrate the setting up of a particular connection with Columbia University in New York, a dual Master of Public Administration has been established. It was established earlier this month. And indeed, Columbia and LSE have worked together on a conference on the state of the planet and aim to do a great deal more work together. And this is one illustration of the range of such university links. And we're very pleased to welcome to us to participate in our discussion this evening Professor Jack Snyder from Columbia University. He's Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of Political Science, and he was also the director of the Institute for War and Peace at Columbia. He's about to publish a new book on democracy and war. And he will be the second speaker this evening. The first speaker, also in some sense representing, in a sense, the process of globalization, the first speaker is Professor Gwyn Prince, who is the first New Alliance Research Professor affiliated jointly with LSE and Columbia. We're also celebrating the launch of his new book, Heart of War, which is published by Routledge, was published in August 2002. I have here a copy. I'm sure that Professor Prince would be very willing to sign copies of this at the end of our show. And Professor Prince will be the first speaker this evening. Then we will have two discussants, both from the Department of International Relations at LSE. Professor Margot Light, who is the convener of the department at present, and is a specialist, I think, on Central and Eastern Europe, apart from international relations generally, international relations theory. And Dr. Karen Smith, who is lecturer in international relations, specializing in the foreign policies of the European Union, particularly, I think, with regard to Central and Eastern Europe. So we have quite a rich menu for you this evening. Professor Prince will start, then Professor Snyder, and my two colleagues from the International Relations Department will act as discussants. So please welcome Professor Prince, who will sign his book later.
Thank you very much indeed. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is deep autumn in Russia now, and last Tuesday, the grand but decaying buildings of the Smolny in St. Petersburg, which now houses the School of International Relations, were bathed in a rather weak autumn sunshine. And with the dean of the school, Professor Khudaloy, I conducted for the whole day a seminar of the sort which couldn't happen 10 years ago, a joint European-Russian seminar with undergraduates from Russian universities and European universities on the question of the nature of terror and terrorism. Professor Khudaloy expressed the view that the Chechen crisis was part of the global struggle with terrorism. I politely disagreed and said I thought that Mr. Putin's tactics were bound to fail. And we both agreed, to the bemusement of the students, that actually the United States was not the primary target of the 11th of September. And then the next day, I got an aeroplane to come home, and those who went to see Nord Ost settled down into their theater seats in Moscow for the beginning of the show. The events of the last few days in Russia have been much represented in the Russian press as being the Russian equivalent of the 11th of September. A common formulation is to say that the Americans had their 11th of September, the Australians had theirs at Bali, and now the Russians have had theirs in Moscow. And what everybody is saying, what the leaderships are all saying, is that somehow something profound is shifting in the nature of international politics. I think that's true. Although I don't think that the principal motivator of that are the acts of international terror. In fact, I think that the last year has shown something quite striking, because if you look at both government statements and the press on both sides of the Atlantic, there is a common feature, which is that there's, I think, a declining ability to distinguish priorities and relationships among threats. And that has stoked public hysteria. Witness only recently the reaction in the States to the Washington sniper. And for those of us in this school, who are by definition students of history, all of this should sound familiar, because these are the classic signs of a revolutionary moment. Now, the great French historian Fernand Braudel reminds us that simply to look at events in their own terms is a dangerous undertaking. Events are too febrile. They don't give us a sufficient basis to make the judgments which we are called in an institution like this, and which indeed we are pursuing through the new alliance with Colombia, the sort of judgments we are called upon to make, which are trend-level judgments. That's our primary responsibility. So it's to trends that I want to turn our attention this evening, and to sketch for you very briefly a thesis, which is that at this moment we are moving. We are moving from interregnum into a general crisis. Now, I start by asserting that we have, in the last year or so, clearly come to the end of the post-Cold War interregnum. An interregnum, the period between kings, the king is dead. Long live what? Who? For 10 years, we did not know. Mr. Gorbachev set in train things which he could not fully anticipate, which led to the implosion of the Soviet Union, and indeed we entered an interregnum period. And we then had a decade, the decade of the 1990s, which was basically a decade of lost opportunities. We lost collectively the golden moment with Russia, the moment to come to a historic new relationship with Russia and Russians and Russian people. We lost the United Nations' chance to transition out of its Cold War role into that of becoming an executive power. And in the poor world in particular, we lost the chance to preempt AIDS or anthropogenic climate forcing, both of which are going to be rising security drivers for the rest of our lifetimes. So that was the 1990s, and we could see these things happening, but we couldn't see what was coming next. And I want to suggest this evening a thesis which my colleagues will criticize and we can all discuss, which is that we can now begin to see at the trend level of analysis what is coming next. And what is coming next is a general crisis. And I use the term in the strict sense, because general crises don't happen every 5 and 20 minutes. In fact, this is the first one to have occurred since the last one, which was in the 18th century, and which was brought to a premature termination by the French Revolution, because it answered one of the two key questions which define what makes a general crisis. The first question, which was in contention during the First World War, the war which raged from the late 17th right the way through the 18th century, was fought on the battlefields of Plassey in Bengal, the French-Indian Wars, the Battle of Saratoga. That was the issue of who was going to be the global hegemon, France or Britain. And by the end of the 18th century, the question was answered. It was going to be Britain in terms of the overseas empire. And so the first question in any general crisis is who is going to be the hegemon. But the second, and in many ways the most interesting defining characteristic of a general crisis, is that it's an occasion where there is a reworking of the social contract. All that web which connects individuals to any form of superordinate power. And events like the Washington Sniper, which was the most watched television event in the United States since the 11th of September, have served to shake confidence even in the night watchman functions of the competences of the state. But I think that the thing that we should bear in mind is that whilst that is a fairly febrile sign, there is a much longer established and longer building body of evidence which supports this proposition that we're going through this profound reworking. And that is that in all the mature democracies, we have seen a decade-long silent withdrawal, mass withdrawal of populations from formal politics, and an associated refusal to legitimate elite projects, and of course in Europe, most importantly of all, the European Union. Now, ironically, this is more of a change in the rich world than in the poor world, because the politics of the poor world, as I'm sure many of you will know, have never been conducted other than in what is usually called the informal sector, the informal economy, the informal realm of politics. And so therefore, the fact that we are seeing changes in formal political arrangements is rather less disorienting. The major exception, I might add parenthetically, and it's a big parenthesis to all of this, is China. There are, I would suggest, three visible surface traces, what I think we should call strictly second-order phenomena, which show us the nature of the general crisis that we're in. The first is that we see now, I think clearly, the advancing collapse of the post-colonial state settlement that was made at the end of the Second World War in much of the poor world. We see a combination of informal political economies giving very differently imagined moral communities to the formal ones. We see what is much noticed in Washington, the venality and the corruption and the temptations which come from global economic demands in the poor world, largely from the narcotics trade. We see special susceptibility in the poor world to geo-ecological stress, which has an especial effect in creating increased disease pandemic burdens. And then finally, we see now the failure of the 60 years career of, in inverted commas, development as the successor to colonial rule to provide the underpinning social and regime insurance of the rich for the poor. The second of the surface traces of second-order phenomena is that we've seen rather quickly, I would suggest over the last 2 or 3 years, most visibly, the draining of power out of all three of the last remaining American-inspired or American-encouraged mid-20th century multilateral institutions. NATO is now dead. It was accidentally assassinated by the Americans last year. It wasn't their intention. Having got it to vote historically the Article 5 activation after September the 11th, the failure then to use NATO in the context of the war in Afghanistan has been, I think, fatal, combined with the enlargement, which will be agreed at the funeral of this organization, which will take place at the Prague summit. Secondly, we see the death of the European Union, which is clearly now disintegrating under a five-way pull of the profound effects of the Franco-German divergence, which began actually over Yugoslavia in the early 1990s and which is still working its way through at several levels. The stress of accelerated enlargement, coupled with diminishing popular validation, most recently in the Irish vote, of course, where the most significant figure was not the approval of the Nice Treaty, but the fact that even under the most intense pressure, still less than half of all Irish voters could be got out to vote. It's always important to remember that there's never been a decisive democratic validation of the formal European project in any European country, including France. The most significant result of all in the last 30 years, you'll remember, being the result Mitterrand obtained in the referendum on the Maastricht Treaty, where the French gave him a delicious mandate of less than 1%. We see at the same time the elite beginning now to learn the lesson of this, and we see the retrenchment into balance of power politics, which is the overriding political message of the Nice Treaty, if you read it, the abandonment of the instrumentation set up through the Commission and so on, and the return to capitals as the centers of power. And finally, we have the irresolvable incompatibilities of the euro, where the problems will simply, that we're seeing now on a daily basis, will continue to mount. Nobody knows how to produce an integrated interest rate or borrowing strategy which will cover the existing range of essentially divergent, cyclically divergent economies. The United States, when it became a federal state, after all, went 45 years before having a united dollar. The third is the United Nations, which we see having lost its chance to gain executive power during the boom and bust of peacekeeping in the 1990s, and which now faces its equivalent of what happened to the League of Nations over the issue of the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, over the question of the vote on Iraq. It's under a three-way pull. On the one hand, a fractious General Assembly, which is stuffed with the representatives of dubiously legitimate regimes. Secondly, the failure of what's often called the Big Bang strategy, the enormous mega conferences, most recently that which was held in Johannesburg, the World Summit on Sustainable Development, and the associated diminution both in funding, which is rather important, and in power of the acronymic agencies, the baronies, the FAO, and all the others that were set up as agencies for UN action. And coupled with that, the third pull is a sharply constrained Security Council, where we see patently, as we are sitting here this evening, France and Russia playing their last residual big power cards, which is their ability to command veto in the Security Council, in face of the arrival of the American imperial moment. Because the third of the key traces of the general crisis, the defining aspect, is the arrival of this combination, this potent combination of what Joseph Nye Jr. calls hard and soft power, which the United States possesses, which in my reading of history is without parallel since the last occasion that we had such a combination and such a range of power, which was in the second century, that is to say the Augustinian period of the Roman Empire. The role and the description of the United States as an empire are hotly resisted in the United States. They're very easily in political circles conflated. People find a red mist descending over their eyes. They cannot distinguish between the description of the fact of empire and an accusation of imperialism, against which, as a country which had its origins breaking out of an empire, they rebel. And we see that in the reluctance of the United States hitherto to take on its imperial responsibilities, for example, in full-cycle execution of virtuous interventions in defense of human rights, of which the support of the Karzai regime would be a modest example. And all of this, in conclusion, makes the next stage into which we move more problematic than it needs to be. But I think that it does help to define the responsibilities and the research priorities for all of us, and in particular for those of us at the research design level in both the LSE and in Columbia, in this newly forged alliance between our two universities. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Quince. And now, Professor Byron.
it really is a pleasure to be here to help move forward the intellectual dialogue between Columbia and LSE. I spent some time at LSE about a decade ago when I was working on a book on empires, and I profited tremendously from the international historians here who helped me a lot with my research, and I'm really looking forward to having a chance to start up again that sort of very profitable interchange. I also wear a bureaucratic hat at Columbia. This year I'm the director of the Masters of International Affairs program, and one of the things that I'll be doing over the next couple of days while I'm here is talking to people about their ideas for how LSE and Columbia can cooperate in this enterprise. Well, tonight, Gwynne has told us about the general crisis that we're entering. My take on future trends is more ambivalent than the story that Gwynne told. I have good news and bad news about the future of war and peace in the international system. Now, like the jokes that start off, there's good news and bad news. They usually start with the good news, and although this is not a joking matter by any means, I'm also going to stick to the convention and start with the good news. I think there are three reasons to believe that the world is headed, in the long run, toward peace and away from the anarchic war system that has dominated international relations since the time of Thucydides. The first reason is that no democracy has ever fought a war against any other democracy. That is, if you're reasonably strict about how you define democracy and how you define war. And now, most of the great powers are democracies. Over the past two decades, there's been a trend toward the consolidation of new democracies worldwide, and this has had the effect of expanding the size of the democratic zone of peace. The second reason to be optimistic about future trends is that there's been a dramatic increase in the energy and organization of global civil society, especially activist networks promoting democracy, promoting human rights, and promoting the settlement of disputes by the rule of law. These networks use powerful tools of persuasion and communication to press arguments and to hold disruptors of the global peace and justice accountable. The networks are also undertaking painstaking practical work needed to institutionalize a global system based on law and democracy. They've worked hard and been effective. For example, leading a campaign that has banned anti-personnel landmines. There's one more reason, a third reason, why we should be optimistic about future trends. This reason may surprise you, given what's going on at the moment. But my third reason is the rise of U.S. hegemonic power, which could be deployed to help consolidate the first two trends that I've been talking about. There's no peer competitor that can organize global resistance to the United States if it gets behind these trends and acts effectively on their behalf. So as these three trends unfold, I think there's a real chance that international relations will, in the long-term future, look fundamentally different than it has before, and that is likely to be all for the better. However, there's also the bad news, which is that each of these three trends has the potential to increase the chance of war in the short run. Indeed, if the short run gets out of hand, the promising long-run trends that I've been talking about may get derailed entirely. So let me talk about these short-run dangers. First of all, although democratic consolidation has a tendency to lead to peace, in the early stages of transitions to democracy, this leads to an increase in the likelihood of ethnic conflict and international war. This has been true since the French Revolution and down through the failed democratic transitions more recently in the former Yugoslavia in the late 1980s, in Burundi in Central Africa, in the Caucasus, the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, more recently in Indonesia, where the democratic transition has coincided with increases in separatist violence and backlash, and also in Nigeria, where the transition to an electoral political system has led to social polarization and the worst violence that country has seen in a couple of decades. Now, why is this the case? Why does the beginning stages of a transition toward democracy have a tendency to lead to nationalist and ethnic violence? Well, one reason is that threatened old elites wrap themselves in the mantle of nationalism to try to hang on to power, the way Milosevic did in Serbia, but also that rising new elites try to rally support for their own political ascendancy with populist appeals to indigenous culture, to ethnicity. Statistical studies of these kinds of conflicts, both international wars and also civil wars, find that this problem is especially dangerous when the democratic transition gets stuck, where it does not consolidate, but rather gets stuck in a position that's partly democratic, but partly has the remnants of authoritarian politics, and particularly when this occurs in a state that has very weak political institutions. So think, for example, of the contrast between Burundi and South Africa. In Burundi in 1993, the international community told the minority Tutsi dictators of that country, look, you're on the dole for a lot of money from the international community. And if you want to keep getting those funds, you're going to be a democracy. You're going to hold democratic elections. There's going to be power sharing between the minority and the majority. And they forced an electoral process on Burundi, a country that had no political institutions that are needed to support democracy, no tradition of representative government, no institutionalized political parties, no professionalized journalism. And the result was that shortly after the elections, there was an ethnic polarization. The minority Tutsi military that still had all the guns was afraid that if it carried through with the logic of democracy, that it would be not only swept from power, but left vulnerable to the wrath of the newly empowered majority. And as a result of mutual fears on both sides, within a short period of time, over 100,000 people were dead there. Contrast that to South Africa, which democratized in the 1990s in a much different institutional context, where the South African white apartheid regime, although it was certainly not a majoritarian democracy by any means, nonetheless had the institutional infrastructure of democracy already developed there. They had held elections. They had experience with representative democracy. They had political parties. They had professionalized journalists who couldn't always tell the truth, but they were people who knew how to do journalism. They were, most importantly, a rule of law state, although under the apartheid regime, some of the laws were ones that we now find despicable. Nonetheless, they understood what it meant to have a bureaucracy that operated by the rule of law. So that when the transition to democracy happened, they had all of the machinery needed to make a success of it. So the prescriptions that I would draw from this research on democratic transitions and conflict, and in particular from the comparison that I just gave you of Burundi and South Africa, is that first of all, in democratic transitions, it's important to get the sequence right. Build the institutions that are necessary to make democracy work first, and then have mass voting and mass electoral politics later once the institutions are in place. And the second lesson that I would draw is offer worried elites a safe landing in the new democratic environment. Try to make sure that the old authoritarian elites are weak but happy in the new democratic regime so that they don't have an incentive to backlash against political change the way the Tutsi military dictators of Burundi did. Do it like Mandela did and give the old elites a soft landing, as in South Africa. A final remark about the dangers of democratic transitions. One could argue that the democratic transitions that have been successfully consolidated in the 1980s and 1990s included most of the easy cases. Countries that had democratic traditions, that were relatively wealthy, that had some democratic institutions or at least rational government bureaucracies already in place in South America, in Taiwan, Korea, in Eastern Europe. When we look at the future of democratic transitions, I would argue that things are going to look more like Burundi and Indonesia than they will like the easier transitions that we've seen in the past couple of decades. Okay, my second cautionary point is about civil society activists, which, as I was saying at the beginning, are in the long run a force for tremendous good and change in international politics. Nonetheless, I worry that at the present time, civil society activists are often so uncompromising in pursuit of their ideals that they risk undermining the political flexibility that's needed to manage the conflicts in the world today. One example of this is the question of whether there should be tribunals to put on trial perpetrators of atrocities, war crimes, crimes against humanity, or whether there should be amnesties for those bad guys who willingly step down from power or surrender their weapons in a political transition. Now, tribunals are said to deter future atrocities. But if you look at the recent track record of the two tribunals that have been established in Yugoslavia and Central Africa, they haven't deterred future atrocities. Atrocities continued in those regions even after the tribunals were set up, even after indictments were handed down, and even after some criminals were convicted. On the other hand, amnesties, at least when they're part of an overall package that makes sense, have worked, even in really hard cases like Mozambique and El Salvador, countries that you would not have expected to succeed in consolidating democracy or even social peace. General amnesties in those countries were part of a settlement that seems to be working better than any settlement we might have expected. Even in South Africa, where people point to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as something that's helped to establish social peace there, I would argue that the more important thing than the truth-telling was the amnesty that was granted to people who told the truth, taking away their incentive to backlash against the transition and reducing their fears about it. It is, however, true that there are amnesties that have not worked, like in Sierra Leone, where they gave Fode Sanko an amnesty for the atrocities that he perpetrated in the Civil War, but then they didn't take away his power. They left him in charge of diamond mining. So that sort of amnesty, you know, is not what I would be recommending. You got to leave them feeling secure, but also leave them weak when you give them an amnesty. So tribunals also complicate peacemaking. In Macedonia last year, there was a domestic amnesty worked out between the Slavic Macedonian government and the Albanian fighters who had committed atrocities. And as a way of heading off a civil war and the partition of that country, for domestic crimes, the Albanian fighters were given an amnesty, but it didn't cover international crimes that were under the purview of the Hague Tribunal. So despite the domestic amnesty, Carla Del Ponte, the chief prosecutor of the Hague Tribunal, sent investigators last fall into Macedonia to check up on atrocities to see if people should be indicted and tried. And not surprisingly, this led to an intensification of the conflict. The Albanians tried to hide evidence of their atrocities. This was used as an excuse by some of the Slavic Macedonian nationalists to enter Albanian-held territory on the pretext that the Albanian fighters are trying to hide evidence and we can't have that. And for a while there, it looked like things were going to unravel. Luckily, they didn't, but it was a close-run thing. So my prescription from this second of my pessimistic points to try to head off these kinds of outcomes is, yes, have accountability for people who perpetrate war crimes, crimes against humanity, but this accountability process should be guided by political judgment and rules that institutionalize pragmatism. The International Criminal Court does not do this. It has no provision for amnesty as part of the way that it operates. So I think that ending atrocities is so important that we need to have a strategy that actually works to accomplish that goal, not just a strategy that makes us feel good. Now my third pessimistic point is about the vast power of the United States and the problem that U.S. power and that of its democratic allies is not being deployed in a way that finds the right balance between principle and pragmatism in an attempt to institutionalize fundamental change in international relations. I think the United States Lone Ranger policy is misdirected both at the level of pragmatism and at the level of principled support for democratic enlargement. I think that the U.S. government, although it uses the rhetoric of realism and the balance of power, has a perversely backward sense of realpolitik. The book that I was working on when I was visiting LSE a decade ago was called Myths of Empire. And the thesis of the book was that imperial overstretch by everyone from Napoleon to Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany to Adolf Hitler to Imperial Japan was fueled in part by some misguided strategic ideas that the security of the empire could be improved through offensive tactics and through military expansion. And I got a call the other day from one of my colleagues at a different university who said he was using that book in one of his classes. And he said he found it eerie to go through my list of the myths of empire because all of those ideas, he said, are reflected in the current thinking of the Bush administration about grand strategy. So after that phone call, I looked up, you know, some of the recent speeches by Don Rumsfeld, by President Bush, the new national security strategy document that came out a couple of months ago, and lo and behold, everything that I talked about in my book on the myths of empire is right in there. The cult of the offensive, the benefits of preventive war, the notion that if you are forceful and threaten others, they will jump on your bandwagon and become your friend. They won't balance against you. These ideas are the opposite of realpolitik. If you go back to the writings of Otto von Bismarck, the greatest realpolitik diplomat of all time, he had the opposite notions on all counts. He said preventive war is like committing suicide from fear of death. He said that preventive war has the disadvantage of making you look like the aggressive side that threatens everyone else. And in a balance of power system, which is what the international system is, that means that everyone will gang up against you rather than your opponent. So Bismarck's strategy, rather than engaging in preventive wars, was to do the opposite, to wait until the other side could be lured into attacking him, and that way gain a massive alliance to do in the opponent. That's what George Bush the elder had going for him in 1991, and that's exactly what the U.S. is not going to have going for it this time around if we pursue this kind of backwards strategy. Just wanted to mention also that people in American academe who call themselves realists are not for the preventive war against Iraq. People like Kenneth Waltz, John Mearsheimer have, you know, signed advertisements in the New York Times saying that they're against this war, and they're against it on the grounds of violating the basic common sense principles of realpolitik. So let me just close with the remark that I think that the unipolar moment of hypertrophied American power relative to the rest of the world is going to be a 20-year window of opportunity to reform the old war system into one that's based on cooperation, the rule of law, and democracy. And I'm really worried that if we blow this chance, the rise of a Chinese rival power could take place in a context of turbulent democratization, nationalism, and misplaced idealism that, as John Mearsheimer's title of his well-known article puts it, could very well take us back to the future and cause the general crisis that Nguyen was telling us about. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Our two first speakers, we now have the discussants. First of all, Professor Light, then Dr. Smith.
I find myself in a very curious position. A professional pessimist by training and inclination, I find myself wildly optimistic compared to Gwynne Prince. End of interregnum? Yes, but I think not a general crisis. I study a country whose previous ideology was based on the belief that the general crisis of capitalism would lead to international revolution. There was no general crisis of capitalism. Instead, there was the revitalization of capitalism, and there was no international revolution. Instead, there was the collapse of communism. So general crisis has little credibility for me, just as history did not end, and just as there is no clash of civilization, I don't really think there is a general crisis. Nor do I think that this is a revolutionary moment, defined by Lenin, you will remember, as the moment when the masses were no longer prepared to be ruled in the old way, and the ruling classes no longer could or wished to rule in the old way. I see no masses about to rise up against their rulers, and I see no ruling classes who no longer have the political will to rule. Indeed, I see political classes whose will to rule grows day by day. In my view, Gwynne Prince described dangerously and rapidly emptying glasses, and which those glasses are not perhaps half full. I think they are at least acquiring the first drops, and they are the drops that lead to my optimism. He sees, for example, the evident fragility and advancing collapse of the post-colonial state settlement in much of the poor world. I see a greater recognition of the importance of governance and the beginnings of an attempt to establish better government and the principles of governance, and an associated, very slow diminution of the number of failed states. As Jack Snyder's indicated in talking about global civil society, though I must say I disagree with his explanation of the South African transition, and I think Jack might compare not just Burundi and South Africa, but perhaps South Africa and Zimbabwe, which are very like cases with, at the moment, very different outcomes. To go back to Gwynne's thesis, he sees a special susceptibility to geo-ecological stress. I see a recognition of the ecological danger and the first faltering, it is true, steps to do something about it, and also to do something about global disease. I agree that the development successor to colonial rule has manifestly failed, but there is some attempt now to diagnose the failure and to modify development policies. As for the draining of power from the three remaining mid-20th century multilateral institutions, Karen will deal with the European institutions, so I'll just mention the UN. I think it's a curious and a very Bush administration definition of the UN and what it does now to confine itself to the Iraq resolution as the defining and a failure of the UN as a system. And I think it's a very jaundiced view of that resolution that dismisses the French and Russian objection to France and Russia playing their last residual big power cards in face of the arrival of the American imperial moment. Perhaps France and Russia really are trying to temper the way in which the US deploys its power, just as Jack Snyder thinks is necessary. And while it is true that the big bang conferences delivered far less than they promised, they took place, they were not a complete failure. And from them came the beginning of the drops into the glasses that I see as optimistically filling rather than emptying. So yes, we live in perplexing times, and the responsibilities and research priorities of LSE and Columbia are great, but this is all the more reason not to throw up our hands and succumb to cataclysmic visions of the present and the future and the general crisis.
Yes, I think I'm going to add to the good news. I think this is sort of ending on a high note here. I was struck by all of the doom and gloom, I think, in Prince's presentation. And I do want to sort of counter that, or at least try to counter that, with a more optimistic view, perhaps far too rosy view, but concentrating on the European scene. And I want to state quite boldly that Europe is safer and more secure now than it has ever been. Of course, there are exceptions to this, mainly on the periphery, Chechnya, Georgia, Northern Ireland, Cyprus. Of course, there is crime, some of it directed at specific racial groups, and the threat of terrorism and nasty nationalist undercurrents in areas. But people on the continent as a whole are no longer living with the threat of nuclear Armageddon. And the horrible wars in the Balkans have ended. The possibility that they would re-erupt is not as worrisome as it has been. In other words, there is hope. A superpower disappeared, an empire self-destructed. There was progress towards democracy, and the entire continent was not plunged into darkness. Why? Now, I think a considerable amount of credit must be given to Europe's institutions, and the international institutions, not just the domestic ones. Now, of course, we can, you know, point to the failures of those institutions to stop the wars in the Balkans in particular. Yes, of course, we can point to the important role of the United States. But the prospect of including most or even all of the continent under Europe's institutional framework has contributed greatly to the improved security situation in Europe. Now, to consider then the future of the organizations, these organizations, which Gwynne tells us is dire. NATO, arguably, has been in crisis since the end of the Cold War, as it has no enemy any longer. The Balkans gave it something to do. With the Balkans more and more stable, the European Union becomes the prime actor and reference point. Not that that will be easy, but there's a shift from NATO to the European Union. And yes, the future of NATO is in doubt, but is this a bad thing? It did the job. Arguably, it should not be involved outside of Europe. It should not act as a global policeman, much less the police arm of the United States. It could be quite useful as a larger forum to talk about things like civilian control of the military, peacekeeping, and so on, with all of the new member states that are going to join, but it is no longer needed in the sense that it was needed during the Cold War. And furthermore, should not the transatlantic relationship be built on much more than a U.S. defense guarantee? To turn then to the European Union, it is not disintegrating. The Franco-German partnership has gone through ups and downs since well before 1990 and is probably robust enough to survive the downs. It was strong enough just this weekend to prevent any kind of reform on the cap. that undoubtedly there are tensions, but this is not new. We go through this all the time on the Franco-German relationship. I would also argue that the second Irish referendum is not an indication of mass silent withdrawal of populations. There was a higher turnout and a higher yes vote, particularly when it counted. Everybody in Ireland knew what the stakes were at the second, in the second referendum, and they didn't turn it down the second time. There wasn't a mass rejection of the European Union. The European Union currently is undergoing an intensive period of constitutional renewal, with the unprecedented participation of civil society, here we come to the civil society, role of civil society groups, and nationally based officials and parliamentarians. And this, the current Convention on the Future of the EU, was precisely a reaction to the intergovernmentalism of Nice. So it's inward looking at this time, which could present some problems for us, but the implications of the changes are enormous. There is a chance to move from an elite-centered project in Europe to one with much wider legitimacy and more efficient decision-making mechanisms. Finally, just one word on enlargement. I was surprised to hear it called accelerated by Gwynne. I don't think that if you're sitting in Prague or Warsaw, you think that this was a particularly fast process. But enlargement, I think, is unprecedented. And arguably, it is this process, the process of enlargement, not just of the European Union, but of other institutions, but I think primarily of the EU, that has stabilized and secured the Central and East European countries and has the potential to do the same elsewhere, particularly in Southeastern Europe. Now, we don't know what the effects of enlargement will be. We should note, however, that the European Union has enlarged from 6 member states to 15, and still integration has proceeded. The EU has not disintegrated, even with more than a doubling of its membership. So we cannot categorically state that enlargement will destroy the European Union. It will change it, but not necessarily destroy it. Now, this is not to underestimate the problems facing Europe, but to assert that there is a crisis, a profound, deep, general crisis, I think, particularly from the perspective of Europe, is far too gloomy an outlook. And I think one of the key issues that does need to be on the agenda, however, is how Europe can spread this good news. In other words, how can it work with this global hegemon, the United States, on things like reforming the international system? This is the question. But to say that it's a general crisis rather than a challenge, I think, is taking a step too far.
Thank you very much indeed, Karen. I think the way to proceed is for our two first speakers to have a first bite at replying to the discussant's comments, and they will have a brief period, with their permission, of questions from the floor.
Thanks very much. Is this system doing dreadful things to your hearing? Try and step back from it. Well, just two quick reactions, please. The first, if I may take them in reverse order, is I want politely to step out of the corner into which I've been invited to be painted. I don't actually feel optimistic or pessimistic, nor does the general crisis thesis imply pessimism. What I was trying to do was to invite us to examine pieces of evidence which are hard to interpret, but which I think can be persuasively represented in a pattern which is not unfamiliar from the past. And the most important aspect of a general crisis, as I try to make clear, is that it's a moment, and this is why it is, because I don't agree with Margot about this, it is a revolutionary moment. It's a moment where we see a profound reinterpreting of the relationships that individuals have with each other and with the wider society in which they live. It's a theme that Tony Giddens has been banging away at for 15 years, and which now everybody's noticed he was actually right about. Now, that means that I'm in pretty much agreement with what Jack was saying about the potential interactions of the three forces that he describes. I think we are indeed in this American imperial moment, and it has all the potentials of a revolutionary moment, where it could be a force for the strengthening of those, what he represents as positive roles of global civil society, or it could be a force for ill. That, to me, is the definition of a revolutionary moment. It's when you can think of 5 or 6 entirely plausible ways out of the present moment, and you have no idea which one it's actually going to be. Now, that being so, having now wished to shed quite firmly this notion that the thesis is, by use of the word crisis, pessimistic, because I don't believe that that is the case. What I would like to say is just a word, if I may, on the particular comments that were made by Margot and Karen. I would like Margot to be able to share the view that the glass is filling rather than emptying in the two areas that you spoke of. They're areas which you and I both have worked on and cared about for a long time. I'm afraid I don't see the evidence that way. I really don't. I particularly don't see that with regard to the response in much of the poor world faced with the related forces of anthropogenic climate change, which hits them worst, and the changes that that has on the disease pandemic environments which they now face. It's always important to remember, and this is a reason for pessimism, that we're only just now at the end of the first part of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. We're just about to see the beginning of the prevalence phase of AIDS in Southern Africa and the second wave of onset in Asia, which is coming because it's now committed, is on its way. And it will be in the country which has appeared twice in the discussions. I mentioned it once in a parenthesis. Jack came to it quite strongly, but which I think does present for all of us the most important enigma, which is what China will do in the face of all of these conflicting forces with which we have been wrestling in our minds so far this evening. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that it is a quite crucial one for us to consider. Karen is, of course, correct that what's happened to NATO is that it's now become, in a rather ironic way, what the Soviet Union always wanted it to be, which is a sort of OSCE with teeth. The enlargement of NATO, ironically, is an act which, by the act of enlargement, destroys the thing that the people wanting to join it wanted to join, because you can't run the old NATO at the numbers which will be now brought in, which is fine. That's why I strongly support the idea that Russia should now become an active member of NATO. It's taken a quite different route into the future. And so, pari passu, are the formal structures of the European Union. See, I think that maybe the big difference between us is that I'm not one of those who believes that there's an inherent virtue in creating institutional structures. And clearly I'm not alone in that, because the great forces of social change that we're seeing in the world today are not operating through or in approval of or under the control of those large multilateral structures, which is why the power's draining out of them. And this, I think, is the invitation to the debate, as it were, that I want to put forward, that I want very firmly to insist that it's neither a pessimistic nor an optimistic description. It is, however, a description. I'm not offering a prescription. I wouldn't be so bold.
Jack.
I just have one quick response on the very good point that Margot made about Zimbabwe. And you know, Zimbabwe is certainly closer to South Africa than Burundi in terms of what it had going for it at the moment where it started its democratic transition. Nonetheless, and one of the reasons why this breakdown has taken so much longer. Nonetheless, I would say that that goes to prove my larger point that you know, even in the Zimbabwes of the world, which had some institutional and economic basis for establishing a successful democratic transition, even there, this is a process that is fraught with danger and difficulty. Zimbabwe is not like the Czech Republic. It's not like Brazil. It's not even, you know, entirely like South Africa. And that's my worry about democratic transitions going forward, is that we've already done most of the easy cases and we're left with the Zimbabwes.
Thank you, Jack. I think we have time for a few questions. Anyone have a question to put? I see one at the back there.
Professor Snyder, regarding his view on bad cases for democratic transitions and good cases for democratic conditions, you're saying that South Africa had an easy time of it because it already had a representative, but not entirely representative, government, that it had institutions for a sort of democracy, and that it had a sort of press. Is that's correct, right? And so what in situations where these don't exist, where are we left? Are we left back to the system of imperial tutelage? Or is the hegemon supposed to come in and set up these institutional affairs? Is it not possible for native societies to generate a democratic transition locally?
In terms of the sequence, in my view, efforts at democracy assistance should begin with programs to develop the institutional basis for democracy on a broad front, starting with the bureaucracy of the state, and try to establish a rational legal bureaucracy that has administrative training and functions objectively, and that until you have something like a rational legal state, democracy is meaningless, because, you know, democratic control of the state presumes that there's a working state to control. And along with that, more broadly, the other aspects of rule of law, institutionalizing political competition, and so forth, that we've both mentioned, in terms of how you do that and who's responsible for it. You know, in some cases it may be that leaders of developing countries will see incentives for themselves to strengthen the rationality of administration in their state. Karzai, you know, may be an example of someone who has strong incentives to try to build a rationally institutionalized state. But as your question implies, sometimes people running authoritarian countries really don't want to get away from the patrimonial, patronage-based, corrupt state because that's what sustains them in their power. And in that case, the international community, you know, may have a harder task in influencing them to take steps in the direction that I'm recommending. You know, I'm not saying that this is easy. I think it's very hard. But I'm just pointing out that there are dangers if people think it's easy and do things like we did in Burundi and say you will have elections within a few months. I think, for example, in Iraq, if the United States conquers Iraq, I would be in favor of working on state building first and hold elections further on down the line. This, it seems to me, is actually now conventional wisdom about Bosnia, where the international experts who look back now on how things went in Bosnia are frequently saying one of the mistakes we made was having elections too soon, because in that way we just legitimated the nationalist politicians there.
The question at the back there.
I heard mention of democracy, balance of power, and multilateralism. But I didn't hear anything said about international law as a means for maintaining stability and effecting reform in the international system. What do you think American hegemony and rise of the American imperial moment means for international law?
You want to talk about this?
Well, actually, I did hear a word about that, which was said particularly by Jack. Is this thing on?
I did hear a word about that, and it was said by Jack, and I agreed with what he said. This is a moment where, and I think we are in agreement about this, as we move into the imperial moment, the United States will have some rather important choices. Imperial hegemons always do. And in this case, we're in a position where we can actually feel a degree more optimism than faced with some of the other empires that we have seen in the not-so-distant past. Because the United States is, in its own constitution, with a capital C and with a small c, a state and a people which is rather strongly committed to the principles of international support of human rights in particular. One of the things that's fortunate for us as we enter the 21st century is that the imperial hegemon is an old country, meaning that it's a country which is still running a pre-French revolutionary constitution, a cosmopolitan constitution, and that's a good thing. And I agree with him that one of the things to be fought for is to strengthen those forces within the American body politic, broadly constructed, that do support those things, because on that basis we will be able to have a supported international rule of law. And it touches rather the question of the previous gentleman in this regard, because no, there are no two things about this. It will not be done other than in an imperial context, which means that there has got to be, if not the active support, then at least not the active opposition of the imperial power, which is why the United Nations, by the way, does face this rather difficult moment of truth, not for all the aspects of what it does, but for its central political purpose at this time. And we don't know how this one's going to come out, but it's everything to play for. And if that was the implication of your question, I would support it.
Yeah, I just wanted it's very important to have as a long-term goal strengthening the rule of law, both in failed states that don't have the rule of law and in the international system where the rule of law is often honored in the breach, at least on important political questions. But we must not act in these kinds of anarchical environments as if international law already held sway. We have to have a political strategy that first develops an effective, stress effective, political coalition for the strengthening of rule of law, and secondly, sets in place effective, stress effective institutions through which international law can operate. And we can't get the cart before the horse. We need to have the political strategy in order to move to a more law-based way of regulating political relations. And it's a very difficult question how you can be expedient even as you are trying to move in a direction of more principled law-based behavior. It's a tough one.
I think we have time for two more questions, one down there and one up there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You have actually already slightly referred to it, but the one hears a lot about, I think, this clash of civilizations that Samuel Huntington talking about, mainly Islam, and there is, I think, a general visualization of Islamic life and civilization. And could either of the two speakers say what their future think of this, well, American allies with the Muslim world, the general relationship between the Muslim world and the industrial democracies? It seems to be, I mean, we've had three acts of terrorism which people who are suspicious could say, well, Bali, Moscow and New York, they came from certain groups within the Muslim world, but obviously I think there's a more cooperative approach which also exists. So I'd be interested in your views.
When I said at the very beginning of my remarks that last week in St. Petersburg, the dean of the School of International Relations and I had agreed, to the bemusement of the students, that the United States was not the primary target of the 11th of September, it's that point which was very much in our minds. And the point is that what we are looking at, one of the greater tragedies of the 20th century, has been the inability of the Islamic world, particularly in the Arab world, to come to terms with modernity. There's an argument which I think is a profound and strong one, and a tragic one. I've heard it particularly from one of my colleagues in Pakistan who, in fact, if you read Prospect, he published it just two issues ago, Pervez Musharraf. And you'll find there what that he argues is that the great tragedy for Islam is that this is the religion and the society to which the West owed the preservation of Greece and Rome during the period of our so-called Dark Ages. And yet now we have a situation where the sealing off of the majority of the Islamic world from the wider community, as indicated, for example, in the United Nations survey that was done by a number of Arab scholars earlier this year on questions of translation, where fewer books are translated into Arabic over a 10-year period than are translated into Greek in a 1-year period. These sort of indicators are profoundly worrying, because what they show is that where you have a religious system which, unlike Christianity, doesn't actually have a structure that permits of a reformation, because there aren't high centers of power which can be reacted against, then the resolution of that, coming on top of the, if you like, the special anguish that's come from the 20th century experience of the Middle East, composed both of oil and of the reestablishment of the State of Israel, those together understandably have created this great heat and anger and principally inward-turned violence, because it has been principally inward-turned up until relatively recently, and remains actually principally inward-turned. The principal objective of Mr. Bin Laden is only incidentally to hurt the Americans. It's to deal with what are perceived as the treacherous regimes, the House of Saud, the Egyptian regime, the Pakistani regime. It's no surprise that the perpetrators of these acts, as we've come to know them, have tended to be from middle-class Saudi or Egyptian backgrounds.
Just to agree, I think the U.S. has been on the wrong side of the legitimate aspirations of the Arab peoples for some time now, and we need to come up with a progressive vision of, you know, that's a positive one, of how the U.S. can rectify that. But, you know, we've painted ourselves into a corner where it's now going to be very difficult to somehow just switch sides and abandon the regimes in the Middle East that are so hated by their own peoples. So it's going to be, even if we come up with a strategy that is aimed at moving towards the fulfillment of those legitimate aims, it'll be very difficult to implement. But I'm quite sure that the Bush administration's policy of preventive war in Iraq to set up a model democracy that other Arab peoples will want to emulate is not a strategy that has much likelihood of success.
A last question.
In response to the panel's discussion on post-colonial society's transition to democracy, I would just like to suggest that the experience of India has been completely omitted, because India is a country with a vibrant democracy. It has a 250 million middle class and very strong democratic institutions. In fact, when Indira Gandhi imposed emergency on the country, she was removed by democratic means. So I was a little disappointed not to hear anything on India. Finally, I'd just like to ask Professor Prinz about his third thesis regarding the analogy of the United States as an imperial power comparable to Rome during Augustinian times. Now, what exactly do you mean? Because in the present situation, although America is waging a war on terror, it doesn't have, I would say, absolute control of that war.
Thank you very much. Those are very perceptive and good questions, and you're quite right to draw attention to the Indian experience. The Indian experience, as I understand it, and I'm sure you'll correct me afterwards if I'm wrong, is a particularly interesting example of how to achieve a successful democratic transition, because what it has built into it is a safety valve mechanism. I think it is the case, certainly the last time I checked, which was about 3 years ago, it certainly was, that in the years of India's independence, there has not been a single year where there has not been at least one province that has been under president's rule. President's rule means that when a situation arises in a particular part of the country where democratic processes are at threat, then effectively direct rule, to use a familiar British analogy, is imposed until such time as circumstances permit it, that elections can then be held and democracy can be restored. So it really is like a safety valve, and it has worked extraordinarily well in the Indian experience, and so the country can justly describe itself as the world's largest democracy. India is faced with one of the two most important new wave pandemic problems over the next 30 years, because India is the seat of, along with China, of the most important, still not revealed, bases of infection from the AIDS and HIV pandemic, and associated with that, what's often called in epidemiology, the Bonnie and Clyde effect, that after that you then get the infectious diseases which opportunistically come. And these are utterly debilitating things. I mean, it's hard for, you know, comfortable and relatively safe place like this to try and convey what a degree of fundamental breakdown of security of every sort, physical, psychological, political, social, is implied in the sort of circumstance into which parts of Central and now much of Southern Africa have been cast. So this is going to be a huge challenge. And the Indian experience is, because it's been, in my view, so strong over the previous four generations of independence, has a great deal from which we might learn. Turning to your second point, thank you for that, because the reason that I drew the comparison with Augustinian Rome is not just for effect. I did it because if you look back at the intervening empires of the previous millennium, well, of course, the first thing to remember is that periods of imperial rule are not the exception. They are the rule in the way that we run international affairs over the last 1,000 years. So it's unusual when we don't have a period with empires either dominant or in contention. And what makes the American moment look so Roman, apart from the fact that all of the neoclassical buildings on the Mall in Washington point in that direction, is what Joe Nye, I think, rather nicely calls the combination of hard and soft power. And it's a point to which Jack pointed, I think, quite correctly in the second, what he called his pessimistic list. Because the United States, and here is a paradox, yes, it is the world's most awesome military power. It has all of these planes and battleships and God knows what. But military power is fragile power. The history of empires, if it teaches anything, teaches us that. And empires which successfully endure, as the British Empire did in the Indian subcontinent, for example, ultimately do so not because the gunman holds his gun, but because, as Anthony Lowe once rather nicely put it, the magician weaves his magic. And that's soft power. That's the fact that in the world today, in the heads of everybody, whoever they are on whichever side in the Balkans, whoever they are on whichever side they are in the Middle East, in everybody's head, there is something which is often crudely represented as a sort of mixture of Hollywood and Coca-Cola and McDonald's, but it's more than that. There is an idea of America. There's an ideal of America. There's been some very interesting opinion polling done among Palestinians just recently, you perhaps know of this, which indicated, not surprisingly, enormous distaste with America's formal politics in the Middle Eastern region and enormous affection and admiration for the American way of life and aspiration to live that way. If you want to be slightly more cynical about it, and I've been accused of that implicitly several times in the course of this evening, look only at what dictators do when their wives become pregnant. They quickly send them to the United States, not only so that they get good medical care, but of course that the child will then be born with an American passport, which is a very useful thing to have in a world of uncertainties.
Let me just say a little bit about India. I actually had a short case study of Indian democracy in my book From Voting to Violence, which deals with nationalism and democratization. And the India case there I presented as a kind of South Africa-type case that had a legacy of strong democratic institutions, institutionalized political parties, a very well-developed free press at the moment of independence and transition to full democracy. So in that sense, it was in my good case pattern. Nonetheless, I also argued, and this is not my argument, but arguments that I found in the secondary literature, that over time, you had two things happening in Indian democracy. One was an increase in mass political participation as people in rural areas became more literate, more active in politics. And at the same time, you had a kind of deinstitutionalization of some of the machinery of Indian democracy, particularly the Congress Party, partly as a result of the political tactics of Indira Gandhi that ruined some of the internal processes by which Congress had kept things together. And that as a result of these two processes, the increasing mass political participation and the decrease in the strength of political institutions, you got what Sam Huntington calls, you know, this gap between participation and institutions, which hits increasingly in the early 90s, and at that point you get the heating up of the Kashmir dispute and the rise of some of the minority political parties and separatist movements and so forth. I don't think that this is leading to the unraveling of Indian democracy. In fact, I think they've adjusted reasonably well to these challenges.
Well, it remains for me to say, to thank our speakers, primary speakers and our discussants for think, an extremely interesting discussion. It is, I think, extremely difficult to try to understand how the various parts of the big picture fit together, and I'm sure you'd help if you'd agree with me in saying that this has been approached very effectively this evening. It bodes very well for future cooperation between LSE and Columbia, I trust.
We trust.
And also for Gwynne Prince's book. So,
of which there's a large pile in the Economist's bookshop.
So let us thank all the speakers. Thank you very much.